This is me, Keith Richards. And what you've got is the audio version of Life, my autobiography. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm grateful to my friend Johnny Depp for doing this. Somewhere I say that for many years I slept, on average, twice a week, and this means that I've been conscious for at least three lifetimes. Well, that is so, but believe it or not, I remember everything. So get ready for the ride. It starts with a bang. It starts at a moment when I was in deep trouble. When was I not? When everything, Rolling Stones and all, looked as if it was going to come to a sticky end on a country road in Arkansas. I used up my nine lives long ago, but here I am. I'm still playing, and I'm still rocking and still rolling. And I survived to tell this tale. And I hope you enjoy it. One love. Thanks and praises to you all.
Chapter 1, in which I am pulled over by police officers in Arkansas during our 1975 U.S. tour, and a standoff ensues. Why did we stop at the Four Dice restaurant in Four Dice, Arkansas for lunch on Independence Day weekend? On any day? Despite everything I knew from 10 years of driving through the Bible Belt. Tiny town of Four Dice. Rolling Stones on the police menu across the United States. Every copper wanted to bust us by any means available, to get promoted and patriotically rid America of these little fairy Englishmen. It was 1975, a time of brutality and confrontation. Open season on the Stones had been declared since our last tour, the tour of 72, known as the STP. The State Department had noted riots, true, civil disobedience, also true. Illicit sex, whatever that is, and violence across the United States. All the fault of us, mere minstrels. We had been inciting youth to rebellion. We were corrupting America, and they had ruled never to let us travel in the United States again. It had become, in the time of Nixon, a serious political matter. He had personally deployed his dogs and dirty tricks against John Lennon, who he thought might cost him an election. We, in turn, they told our lawyer officially, were the most dangerous rock and roll band in the world. In previous days, our great lawyer, Bill Carter, had single-handedly slipped us out of major confrontations devised and sprung by the police forces of Memphis and San Antonio, and now Four Dice, small town of 3,500, whose high school emblem was some weird red bug, might be the one to take the prize. Carter had warned us not to drive through Arkansas at all, and certainly never to stray from the interstate. He pointed out that the state of Arkansas had recently tried to draw up legislation to outlaw rock and roll. Loved to see the wording of the statute. Where there be loudly and insistently four beats to the bar. And here we were, driving back roads in a brand new yellow Chevrolet Impala. In the whole of the United States, there was perhaps no sillier place to stop with a car loaded with drugs. A conservative, redneck, southern community not happy to welcome different-looking strangers. In the car with me were Ronnie Wood, Freddie Sessler, an incredible character, my friend and almost a father to me, who will have many parts in this story, and Jim Callaghan, the head of our security for many years. We were driving the 400 miles from Memphis to Dallas, where we had our next gig the following day at the Cotton Bowl. Jim Dickinson, the southern boy who played piano on Wild Horses, had told us that the Texarkana landscape was worth the car ride, and we were planed out. We'd had a scary flight from Washington to Memphis, dropping suddenly many thousands of feet, with much sobbing and screaming. The photographer, Annie Leibovitz, hitting her head on the roof, and the passengers kissing the tarmac when we landed. I was seen going to the back of the plane and consuming substances with more than usual dedication, as we tossed about the skies, not wanting to waste. So we drove, and Ronnie and I had been particularly stupid. We pulled into this roadhouse called the Four Dice, where we sat down and ordered, and then Ronnie and I went to the John. You know, just start me up. We got high. We didn't fancy the clientele out there or the food, and so we hung in the John, laughing and carrying on. We sat there for 40 minutes, and you don't do that down there. Not then. That's what excited and exacerbated the situation. And the staff called the cops. As we pulled out, there was this black car parked on the side. No number plate. And the minute we took off, 20 yards down the road, we get sirens and the little blinking light, and there they are with shotguns in our faces. I had a denim cap with all these pockets in it that were filled with dope. Everything was filled with dope. In the car doors themselves, all you had to do was pop the panels, and there were plastic bags full of coke and grass, peyote and mescaline. Oh my God, how are we going to get out of this? It was the worst time to get busted. It was a miracle we had been allowed into the States at all for this tour. Our visas hung on a thread of conditions, as every police force in the big cities also knew, and had been fixed by Bill Carter with very hard, long-distance footwork with the State Department and the Immigration Service over the previous 2 years. It was obviously condition zero that we weren't arrested for possession of narcotics, and Carter was responsible for guaranteeing this. I wasn't taking the heavy shit at the time. I'd cleaned up for the tour. And I could have just put all that stuff on the plane. To this day, I cannot understand why I bothered to carry all that crap around and take that chance. People had given me all this stuff in Memphis, and I was loath to give it away. But I still could have put it on the plane and driven clean. Why did I load the car like some pretend dealer? Maybe I woke up too late for the plane. I know I spent a long time opening up the panels, stashing this shit. But peyote's not particularly my line of substances anyway. In the cap's pockets, there's hash, two and alls, some coke. I greet the police with a flourish of the cap and throw pills and hash into the bushes. Hello, officer. Flourish. Oh, have I broken some local law? Pray forgive me, I'm English. Was I driving on the wrong side of the road? And you've already got them on the back foot. And you've got rid of your crap, but only some of it. They saw a hunting knife lying on the seat and would later decide to take that as evidence of a concealed weapon. The lying bastards. And then they made us follow them to a car park somewhere beneath City Hall. As we drove, they watched us, surely, throwing more of our shit into the road. They didn't do a search immediately when we got to the garage. They said to Ronnie, okay, you go in the car and bring out your stuff. Ronnie had a little handbag or something in the car, but at the same time, he tipped all the crap he had into a Kleenex box. And as he got out, he said to me, it's under the driver's seat. And when I go in, I didn't have anything in the car to get. All I've got to do is pretend that I have something and take care of this box. But I didn't know what the fuck to do with it. So basically, I just scrunched it up a bit and I put it under the back seat. And I walked out and said, well, I don't have anything. The fact that they didn't tear the car apart is beyond me. By now they know who they got. Well, looky here. We got some live ones. But then they suddenly didn't seem to know what to do with these international stars stuck in their custody. Now they had to draft in forces from all over the state. Nor did they seem to know what to charge us with. They also knew we were trying to locate Bill Carter. And this must have intimidated them because this was Bill Carter's front lawn. He had grown up in the nearby town of Rector, and he knew every state law enforcement officer, every sheriff, every prosecuting attorney, all the political leaders. They may have started to regret that they tipped off the wire services to their catch. The national news media were gathering outside the courthouse. One Dallas TV station had hired a Learjet to get pole position on the story. It was Saturday afternoon and they were making calls to Little Rock to get advice from state officials. So instead of locking us up and having that image broadcast to the world, they kept us in loose, protective custody in the police chief's office, which meant we could walk about a bit. Where was Carter? Offices shut during the holiday, no cell phones then. It was taking some time to locate him. In the meantime, we're trying to get rid of all this stuff. We're festooned. In the 70s, I was flying high as a kite on pure, pure Merc cocaine, the fluffy pharmaceutical blow. Freddie Sessler and I went to the John. We weren't even escorted down there. Jesus Christ, the phrase that preceded everything with Freddie. I'm loaded. He's got bottles full of Tuinol, and he's so nervous about flushing them down that he loses the bottle and all the fucking turquoise and red pills are rolling everywhere, and meanwhile, he's trying to flush down coke. I popped the hash down and the weed, flushed it. The fucking thing won't flush. There's too much weed. I'm flushing and flushing, and then suddenly these pills come rolling there under the cubicle, and I'm trying to pick them up and fling them in and everything, but I can't, because there's another cubicle in between the one Freddy's in and the one I'm in. So there's 50 pills lying stranded on the floor in the middle cubicle.
Jesus Christ, Keith!
Keep you cool, Freddy. I've got all the ones out of mine. Have you got all the ones out of yours?
I think so.
Okay, let's go in the middle one and get rid of them. It was just raining with fucking shit. It was unbelievable. Every pocket or place you looked. I never knew I had that much coke in my life. The sleeper was Freddy's briefcase, which was in the trunk of the car, as yet unopened, and we knew he had cocaine in there. They couldn't fail to find it. Freddy and I decided we should disown Freddy, strategically, for that afternoon, and say he was a hitchhiker, but one to whom we were happy to extend the powers of our legal advisor, if need be, when he finally appeared on the scene. Where was Carter? It took some time to marshal our forces, while the population of Fordyce was swelling to riot-sized proportions. People from Mississippi, Texas, Tennessee, all coming in to watch the fun. Nothing would happen until Carter was located, and he was on the tour, he wasn't far away, just having a deserved day off. So there was time to reflect how I'd dropped my guard and forgotten the rules. Don't break the law and get pulled over. Cops everywhere, and certainly in the South, have a whole range of quasi-legal tricks to bust you if they feel like it. And they could put you away for 90 days then, no problem. That's why Carter told us to stick to the interstate. The Bible Belt was a lot tighter in those days. We did many miles on the ground in those early tours. Roadhouses were always an interesting gamble. And you better get ready for it and be ready for it. You try going to a truck stop in 1964 or 65 or 66 down south or in Texas. It felt much more dangerous than anything in the city. You'd walk in there, and there's the good old boys, and slowly you realize that you're not going to have a very comfortable meal in there with these truckers with crew cuts and tattoos. You nervously peck away.
Oh, I'll have that to go, please.
They'd call us girls because of the long hair. How you doing, girls? Dance with me? Hair. The little things that you wouldn't think about that changed whole cultures. The way they reacted to our looks in certain parts of London then was not much different from the way they reacted to us in the South.
Hello, darling.
And all that shit. When you look back, it was relentless confrontation. But you're not thinking about it at the time. First off, these were all new experiences, and you were really not aware of the effects it might or might not have on you. You were gradually growing into it. I just found in those situations that if they saw the guitars and knew you were musicians, then suddenly it was totally okay. Better take a guitar into a truck stop. Can you pick that thing, son? Sometimes we'd actually do it. Pull out the guitars, sing for our supper. But then all you had to do was cross the tracks and you'd get a real education. If we were playing with black musicians, they'd look after us. It was, hey, you want to get laid tonight? She'll love you. She ain't seen anything like you before. You got welcomed, you got fed, and you got laid. The white side of town was dead, but it was rocking across the tracks. Long as you knew cats, you was cool. An incredible education. Sometimes we'd do two or three shows a day. They wouldn't be long shows. You'd be doing 20 minutes, half an hour, three times a day, waiting for the rotation because they were mostly review shows, black acts, amateurs, local white hits, whatever. And if you went down south, it was just endless. Towns and states just went by. It's called white line fever. If you're awake, you stare at the white lines down the middle of the road, and every now and again somebody says, I need a crap.
or I'm hungry.
Then you walked into these brief bits of theater behind the road. These are minor roads in the Carolinas, Mississippi and stuff. You get out, dying for a leak. You see Men's, and some black bloke is standing there saying, coloreds only, and you think, I'm being discriminated against. You drive by these little juke joints, and there's this incredible music coming out, and steam coming out the window. Hey, let's pull over here. Could be dangerous. Nah, come on, listen to that shit. And there'd be a band, a trio playing. Big black fuckers, and some bitches dancing around with dollar bills in their thongs. And then you'd walk in, and for a moment, there's almost a chill, because you're the first white people they've seen in there. And they know that the energy's too great for a few white blokes to really make that much difference, especially as we don't look like locals. And they get very intrigued, and we get really into being there. But then we gotta get back on the road. Oh, shit. I could have stayed here for days. You've got to pull out again. Lovely black ladies squeezing you between their huge tits. You walk out, and there's sweat all over you and perfume, and we all get in the car, smelling good, and the music drifts off in the background. I think some of us had died and gone to heaven, because a year before, we were plugging London clubs, and we're doing all right, but actually in the next year, we're somewhere we thought we'd never be. We were in Mississippi. We'd been playing this music, but it had all been very respectful, but then we were actually sniffing it. You want to be a blues player, the next minute you fucking well are, and you're stuck right amongst them, and there's muddy water standing next to you. It happens so fast that you really can't register all of the impressions that are coming at you. It comes later on, the flashbacks, because it's all so much. It's one thing to play a Muddy Waters song. It's another thing to play with him. Bill Carter was finally tracked down to Little Rock, where he was having a barbecue at the house of a friend of his, who happened to be a judge. A very useful coincidence. He would hire a plane and be there in a couple of hours, bringing the judge with him. Carter's judge friend knew the state policeman who was going to search the car, told him that he thought the police had no right to do it, and warned him to hold off a search until he got there. Everything froze for 2 more hours. Bill Carter had grown up working on the local political campaigns from when he was in college, so he knew almost everybody of importance in the state. And people he had worked for in Arkansas had now become some of the most powerful Democrats in Washington. His mentor was Wilbur Mills, chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee, second most powerful man after the president. Carter came from a poor background, joined the Air Force at the time of Korea, paid for law studies with his GI money until it ran out, when he joined the Secret Service, and ended up guarding Kennedy. He wasn't in Dallas that day. He was on a training course. But he'd been everywhere with Kennedy, planned his trips, and knew all the key officials in every state Kennedy had visited. He was close to the center. After Kennedy's death, he was an investigator on the Warren Commission, and then started his own law practice in Little Rock, becoming a kind of people's lawyer. He had a lot of balls. He was passionate about the rule of the law, the correct way of doing things, the Constitution, and he taught police seminars on it. He'd gone into the defense attorney business, he told me, because he got fed up with policemen routinely abusing their power and bending the law, which meant almost all of them he encountered on tour with the Rolling Stones in almost every city. Carter was our natural ally. Carter's contacts in Washington had been his ace card when we were refused visas to tour in the United States in 1973. What Carter found when he first went to Washington on our behalf late that year was that the Nixon dictum prevailed and ran through the bureaucracy down to the lowest level. He was told officially that the Stones would never tour in the United States again. Apart from our being the most dangerous rock and roll band in the world, inciting riots, purveying gross misconduct and contempt for the law, there was widespread anger that Mick had appeared on stage dressed as Uncle Sam, wearing the stars and stripes. That by itself was enough to refuse him entry. It was bunting. You had to guard yourself against being attacked from that area. Brian Jones got pulled in because he picked up an American flag that was lying around backstage in the mid-60s in Syracuse, New York, I think it was. He put it over his shoulder, but a corner of it touched the ground. This was after the show, and we were making our way back, and the police escort barged us all into an office and started screaming, "Dragging the flag on the ground? You're demeaning my nation, an act of sedition." Then there was my record. No getting away from it. It was also widely known. What else did the press write about me? That I had a heroin addiction. I just had a conviction in the UK for possession of drugs in October 1973, and I had been convicted of possession in France in 1972. Watergate was heating up when Carter began his campaign. Some of Nixon's henchmen had been jailed, and Nixon was soon to fall along with Haldeman, Mitchell, and the rest, some of whom had been involved personally with the FBI in the underhanded campaign against John Lennon. Carter's advantage at the Immigration Department was that he was one of the boys. He came from law enforcement. He had respect for having been with Kennedy. He did an "I know how you boys feel," and just said he wanted a hearing because he didn't think we were being treated fairly. He worked his way in, many months of slogging. He paid attention particularly to the lower-level staff, who he knew could obstruct things on technicalities. I underwent medical tests to prove that I was drug-free, from the same doctor in Paris who had given me many a clean bill of health. Then Nixon resigned, and then Carter asked the top official to meet Mick and judge for himself. And of course, Mick put on his suit and charms the pants off him. Mick is really the most versatile bloke. Why, I love him. He can hold a philosophical discussion with Sartre in his native tongue. Mick's very good with the locals. Carter told me he applied for the visas not in New York or Washington, but in Memphis, where it was quieter. The result was an astonishing turnaround. Waivers and visas were suddenly issued on one condition, that Bill Carter toured with the Stones and would personally assure the government that riots would be prevented and that there would be no illegal activities on the tour. They required a doctor to accompany us, who became the tour's only serious victim, getting hooked on drugs and running off with a groupie, leaving his wife and his family practice. Carter had reassured them by offering to run the tour Secret Service style, alongside the police. His other contacts also meant that he would get a tip-off if the police were planning a bust, and that's what saved our asses on many occasions. Things had hardened up since the 1972 tour, with all the demonstrations and anti-war marches in the Nixon period. The first evidence of this was in San Antonio on June 3rd. This was the tour of the giant inflatable cock. It came rising up from the stage as Mick sang Starfucker. It was great, the cock, though we paid for it later in Mick's wanting props at every tour after that to cover his insecurities. There was a huge business of getting elephants on stage in Memphis until they ended up crashing through ramps and shitting all over the stage in rehearsals and were abandoned. We never had a problem with the cock in our opening shows, but the cock was a lure to the coppers who had given up trying to bust us in the hotel or while we were traveling or in the dressing room. The only place they could get us was on stage. They threatened to arrest Mick if the cock rose that night, and there was a mighty standoff. Carter warned them that the kids would burn down the arena. He'd taken the temperature and realized the kids weren't going to stand for it. In the end, Mick decided to defer to the sentiments of the authorities, and it didn't erect itself in San Antonio. In Memphis, when they threatened to arrest Mick for singing the lyrics Starfucker, Starfucker, Carter stopped them in their tracks by producing a playlist from the local radio station that showed they'd been playing it on the air without any protest for 2 years. What Carter saw and was determined to fight every inch of the way was that every time the police moved, in every city, they violated the law, acted illegally, tried to bust in without warrants, made searches without probable cause. So there was some form on the books already by the time Carter finally got to Fordyce with the judge under his arm. A great press corps was established in town. Roadblocks had been erected to stop more people coming in. What the police wanted to do was open the trunk, where they were sure they would find drugs. First they charged me with reckless driving because my tires had squealed and kicked up gravel as I left the restaurant car park. 20 yards of reckless driving. Charge 2. I had a concealed weapon, the hunting knife. But to open the trunk legally, they needed to show probable cause, meaning there had to be some evidence or reasonable suspicion that a crime had been committed. Otherwise, the search is illegal, and even if they find the stuff, the case will be thrown out. They could have opened the trunk if they'd seen contraband when they looked through the car window, but they hadn't seen anything. This probable cause business was what generated the shouting matches that frequently erupted now between the various officials as the afternoon wore on. First off, Carter made it clear that he saw a trumped-up charge. To invent a probable cause, the cop who stopped me said that he smelled marijuana smoke coming through the windows as we left the car park, and this was their cue to open the trunk. "They must think I fell off a watermelon truck," Carter told us. The cops were trying to say that in the minute between leaving the restaurant and driving out of the car park, there was time to light up a spliff and fill the car with enough smoke that it could be smelled many yards away. This was why they arrested us, they said. That alone destroyed the credibility of the police evidence. Carter discussed all this with an already enraged chief of police, whose town was under siege, but who knew he could stop our sold-out concert the following night at the Cotton Bowl in Dallas by keeping us in Fordyce. In Chief Bill Gober, Carter saw, and we saw, the archetype redneck cop, the Bible Belt version of my friends from Chelsea Police Station, always prepared to bend the law and abuse their powers. Gober was a man personally enraged by the Rolling Stones. Their dress, their hair, what they stood for, their music, and above all, their challenge to authority, as he saw it. Disobedience. Even Elvis said, "Yes, sir." Not these long-haired punks. So Gober went ahead and opened the trunk, warned by Carter that he would challenge him all the way to the Supreme Court. And when the trunk was opened, that was the real creamer. It was legs-in-the-air laughter. When you cross the river from Tennessee, then mostly a dry state, into West Memphis, which is in Arkansas, there were liquor stores selling what was basically moonshine with brown paper labels. Ronnie and I had gone berserk in one of them, buying every bizarre bottle of bourbon with a great label. Flying Cock, Fighting Cock, the Gray Major, little hip flasks with all these exotic handwritten labels on them. We had 60 out in the trunk. So now, we were suddenly suspected of being bootleggers. No, we bought them. We paid for them. So I think all of that booze confused them. This is the 70s, and boozers are not dopeheads. In those days, there was that separation. At least they're men and they drink whiskey. Then they found Freddie's briefcase, which was locked. And he told them he'd forgotten the combination. So they smacked it open, and there, sure enough, were two small containers of pharmaceutical cocaine. Gober thought he had us. Or at least, he had Freddie. Cold. It took some time to find the judge, now late in the evening, and when he arrived, he'd been out on the golf course all day, drinking. And by now, he was flying. Now we have total comedy, absurdity. Keystone Cops, as the judge takes to his bench, and the various lawyers and cops try to get him to follow their versions of the law. What Gober wanted to do was to get the judge to rule that the search and the finding of the coke were legal, and that all of us would be detained on felony charges, i.e., put in the slammer. On this little point of law, arguably, hung the future of the Rolling Stones. In America, at least. What happened then is pretty much as follows, from what I overheard from Bill Carter's later testimony, and this is the quickest way to tell it, with apologies to Perry Mason. The cast. Bill Gober, police chief, vindictive, enraged. Judge Wynn, presiding judge in Fordyce, very drunk. Frank Wynn, prosecuting attorney, the judge's brother. Bill Carter, well-known aggressive criminal lawyer representing the Rolling Stones, native of Arkansas from Little Rock. Tommy Mays, prosecuting attorney, idealistic, fresh out of law school, Others present, Judge Fairley, brought along by Carter to witness fair play and to keep him out of jail. Outside courthouse, 2,000 Rolling Stones fans were pressed against barricades outside the town hall chanting, "Release Keith! Release Keith!" Inside courtroom, Judge. "Now, I think what we are judging here is a felony. A felony, gentlemen. I will take submissions, Mr. Attorney." Young prosecuting attorney. "Your Honor, there is a problem here about evidence." Judge. "Y'all have to excuse me a minute. I'll recess." Perplexity in court. Proceeding held up for 10 minutes. Judge returns. His mission was to cross the road and buy a pint bottle of bourbon before the store closed at 10 p.m. The bottle is now in his sock. Carter, on telephone to Frank Wynn, the judge's brother. "Frank, where are you? You better come up. Tom's intoxicated." "Yeah. Okay. Okay." Judge. "Proceed, Mr. Proceed." Young prosecuting attorney. "I don't think we can legally do this, Your Honor. We don't have justification to hold him. I think we have to let him go." Police chief to judge, yelling. "Damn, we do. You gonna let these bastards go? You know I'm gonna place you under arrest, Judge. You damn right I am. You are intoxicated. You are publicly drunk. You are not fit to sit on that bench. You are causing a disgrace to our community." He tries to grab him. Judge, yelling. "You son of a bitch, get away from me. You threaten me, I'm gonna have your ass out of..." A scuffle. Carter, moving to separate them. "Whoa now, boys, boys. Let's stop squabbling. Let's keep talking. This is no time to get the liver out and put the knives in, ha-ha. We got TV, the world's press outside. Won't look good. You know what the governor's gonna say about this? Let's proceed with the business. I think we can reach some agreement here." Courtroom official. "Excuse me, Judge. We have the BBC on live news from London. They want you now." Judge. "Oh, yeah? Excuse me a minute, boys. I'll be right back." Takes a nip from the bottle in his sock. Police chief still yelling. "Goddamn circus. Damn you, Carter. These boys have committed a felony. We found cocaine in that damn car. What more do you want? I'm going to bust their asses. They're going to play by our rules down here, and I'm going to hit them where it hurts. How much are they paying you, Hoover boy? Unless I get a ruling that search was legal, I'm going to arrest the judge for public drunk." Judge, VO to BBC. "Oh, yeah, I was over there in England in World War II. Bomber pilot, 385th Bomb Group, stationed Great Ashfield. I had a hell of a time over there. Oh, I love England. Play golf. Some of the greatest courses I played on. You got some great ones there. Winworth? Yeah. Now, to inform y'all, we're going to hold a press conference with the boys and explain some of the proceedings here, how the Rolling Stones came to be in our town here and all." Police chief. "I got them here and I'm holding them. I want these limeys, these little fairies. Who do they think they are?" Carter. "You want to start a riot? You're seen outside, you wave one pair of handcuffs, and you will lose control of this crowd. This is the Rolling Stones, for Christ's sakes." Police chief. "And your little boys will go behind bars." Judge, returned from interview.
"What's that?"
Judge's brother, taking him aside. "Tom, we need to confer. There is no legal cause to hold them. We will have all hell to pay if we don't follow the law here." Judge.
"I know it. Sure thing. Yes. Yes, Mr. Carter, you will all approach the bench."
The fire had gone out of all except Chief Gober. The search had revealed nothing that they could legally use. There was nothing to charge us with. The cocaine belonged to Freddy the Hitchhiker, and it had been illegally discovered. The state police were mostly now on Carter's side. With much conferring and words in the ear, Carter and the other lawyers made a deal with the judge. Very simple. The judge would like to keep the hunting knife and drop the charge on that. It hangs in the courtroom to this day. He would reduce the reckless driving to a misdemeanor, nothing more than a parking ticket, for which I would pay $162. With the $50,000 in cash that Carter had brought down with him, he paid a bond of $5,000 for Freddie and the cocaine, and it was agreed that Carter would file to have it dismissed on legal grounds later, so Freddie was free to go too. But there was one last condition. We had to give a press conference before we went, and be photographed with our arms around the judge. Ronnie and I conducted our press conference from the bench. I was wearing a fireman's hat by this time, and I was filmed pounding the gavel and announcing to the press, "Case closed." Phew! It was a classic outcome for the Stones. The choice always was a tricky one for the authorities who arrested us. Do you want to lock them up or have your photograph taken with them and give them a motorcade to see them on their way? There's votes either way. In Fordyce, by the skin of our teeth, we got the motorcade. The state police had to escort us through the crowds to the airport at around 2 a.m, where our plane, well stocked with Jack Daniels, was revved up and waiting. In 2006, the political ambitions of Governor Huckabee of Arkansas, who was going to stand in the primaries as a contender for the Republican presidential nomination, extended to granting me a pardon for my misdemeanor of 30 years previous. Governor Huckabee also thinks of himself as a guitar player. I think he even has a band. In fact, there was nothing to pardon. There was no crime on the slate in Fordyce, but that didn't matter. I got pardoned anyway. But what the hell happened to that car? We left it in his garage, loaded with dope. I'd like to know what happened to that stuff. Maybe they never took the panels off. Maybe someone's still driving it around. Still filled with shit. Chapter 2. Growing up an only child on the Dartford Marshes, camping holidays in Dorset with my parents, Bert and Doris, adventures with my grandfather Gus and Mr. Thompson Wooft. Gus teaches me my first guitar lick. I learned to take beatings at school and later vanquish the Dartford Tech bully. Doris trains my ears with Django Reinhardt, and I discover Elvis via Radio Luxembourg. I morph from choir boy to school rebel. For many years, I slept on average twice a week. This means that I have been conscious for at least 3 lifetimes. And before those lifetimes, there was my childhood, which I ground out east of London in Dartford along the Thames where I was born. December 18th, 1943. According to my mother Doris, that happened during an air raid. I can't argue. All 4 lips are sealed. But the first flash of memory I have is of lying on the grass in our backyard, pointing at the droning airplane in the blue sky above our heads, and Doris saying, "Spitfire." The war was over by then, but where I grew up, you'd turn a corner and see horizon, wasteland, weeds. Maybe 1 or 2 of those odd Hitchcock-looking houses that somehow miraculously survived. Our street took a near hit from a doodlebug, but we weren't there. Doris said it bounced along the curbstones and killed everyone on either side of our house. A brick or two landed in my cot. That was evidence that Hitler was on my trail. Then he went to Plan B. After that, my mom thought Dartford was a bit dangerous, bless her. Doris and my father, Bert, had moved to Moreland Avenue in Dartford from Walthamstow to be near my Aunt Lil, Bert's sister, while Bert was called up. Lil's husband was a milkman who'd been moved there on his new round. Then when the bomb hit that end of Moreland Avenue, our house wasn't considered safe, and we moved in with Lil. When we came out of the shelter after a raid one day, Lil's roof was on fire, Doris told me. But that's where our families were all stuck together after the war, in Moreland Avenue. The house that we used to live in was still there when I first remember the street, but about 1/3 of the street was just a crater, grass and flowers. That was our playground. I was born in Livingstone Hospital, to the sound of the All Clear, another of Doris's versions. I'll have to believe Doris on that one. I wasn't really counting from day one. My mother had thought she was going somewhere safe, moving from Dartford to Walthamstow, so she had moved us to the Darenth Valley. Bomb Alley. It contained the biggest arm of Vickers Armstrong, which was pretty much a bullseye, and the borough's welcome chemical firm. And on top of that, it was around Dartford where German bombers would get cold feet and just drop their bombs and turn around. Too heavy round here. Boom! It's a miracle we didn't get it. The sound of a siren still makes the hair on the back of my neck curl, and that must be from being put in the shelter with Mum and the family. When the sound of that siren goes off, it's automatic, an instinctive reaction. I watch many war movies and documentaries, so I hear it all the time, but it always does the trick. My earliest memories are the standard post-war memories in London. Landscapes of rubble, half a street's disappeared. Some of it stayed like that for 10 years. The main effect of the war on me was just that phrase, before the war. Because you'd hear grown-ups talking about it. Oh, it wasn't like this before the war. Otherwise, I wasn't particularly affected. I suppose no sugar, no sweets and candies was a good thing, but I wasn't happy about it. I've always had trouble scoring. Lower East Side or the sweet shop in East Wittering, near my home in West Sussex. That's the closest I get nowadays to visiting the dealer. The old candies sweet shop. I drove over there at 8:30 one morning not long ago with my mate, Adam Clayton, singer of the Dirty Strangers. We'd been up all night and we'd got the sugar craving. We had to wait outside for half an hour until it opened. We bought candy twirls and bullseyes and licorice and black currant. We weren't going to lower ourselves and score at the supermarket, were we? The fact that I couldn't buy a bag of sweets until 1954 says a lot about the upheavals and changes that last for so many years after a war. The war had been over for 9 years before I could actually, if I had the money, go and say, I'll have a bag of them, toffees and bullseyes. Otherwise it was, you got your ration stamp book? The sound of those stamps stamping. Your ration was your ration. One little brown paper bag. A tiny one. A week. Bert and Doris had met working in the same factory in Edmonton. Bert a printer and Doris working in the office. And they had started out together living at Walthamstow. They had done a lot of cycling and camping during their courtship before the war. It brought them together. They bought a tandem and used to go riding into Essex and camping with their friends. So when I came along, as soon as they could, they used to take me on the back of their tandem. It must have been very soon after the war, or maybe even during the war. I can imagine them driving through an air raid, plowing ahead, Bert in front, Mum behind, and me on the back on the baby seat, mercilessly exposed to the sun's rays, throwing up from sunstroke. It's been the story of my life ever since. On the road again. In the early part of the war before my arrival, Doris drove a van for the co-op bakers, even though she told them she couldn't drive. Luckily, in those days, there were almost no cars on the road. She drove the van into a wall when she was using it illegally to visit a friend, and they still didn't fire her. She also drove a horse and cart for bread deliveries closer to the co-op to save the wartime fuel. Doris was in charge of cake distribution for a big area, half a dozen cakes for 300 people, and she would be the decider of who would get them. Can I have a cake next week? Well, you had one last week, didn't you? A heroic war. Bert was in a protected job in valve manufacturing until D-Day. He was a dispatch rider in Normandy just after the invasion and got blown up in a mortar attack. His mates killed around him. He was the only survivor of that particular little foray, and it left a very nasty gash, a livid scar all the way up his left thigh. I always wanted to get one when I grew up. I'd say, Dad, what's that? And he'd say, it got me out of the war, son. It left him with nightmares for the rest of his life. My son Marlon lived a lot with Bert in America while Marlon was growing up, and they used to go camping together. Marlon says Bert would wake up in the middle of the night shouting, look out, Charlie, here it comes. We're all goners, fuck this shit. Everyone from Dartford is a thief. It runs in the blood. The old rhyme commemorates the unchanging character of the place. Sutton for mutton, Kirkby for beef, South Down for gingerbread, Dartford for a thief. Dartford's big money used to come from sticking up the stagecoach from Dover to London along the old Roman road, Watling Street. East Hill is very steep. Then suddenly, you're in the valley over the River Dart. It's only a minor stream. But then you've got the short high street, and you've got to go up West Hill, where the horses would drag. Whichever way you're coming, it's the perfect ambush point. The drivers didn't stop and argue. Part of the fare would be the Dartford fine, to keep the journey going smoothly. They'd just toss out a bag of coins. Because if you didn't pay going down East Hill, they'd signal ahead. One gunshot. He didn't pay. And they'd stop you at West Hill. So it's a double stick-up. You can't get out of it. That notion had pretty much stopped when trains and cars took over. So probably by the middle of the 19th century, they're looking for something else to do. Some way of carrying on the tradition. And Dartford has developed an incredible criminal network. You could ask some members of my extended family. It goes with life. There's always something falling off the back of the lorry. You don't ask. If somebody's just got a nice pair of diamond somethings, you never ask, where did they come from? For over a year, when I was 9 or 10, I was waylaid Dartford style almost every day on my way home from school. I know what it is like to be a coward. I will never go back there. As easy as it is to turn tail, I took the beatings. I told my mum that I'd fallen off my bike again, to which she replied, stay off your bike, son. Sooner or later, we all get beaten. Rather sooner. One half are losers, the other half bullies. It had a powerful effect on me, and taught me some lessons for when I grew big enough to use them. Mostly to know how to employ that thing little fuckers have, which is called speed. Which is usually run away. But you get sick of running away. It was the old Dartford stick-up. They have the Dartford Tunnel now with toll booths, which is where all the traffic from Dover to London still has to go. It's legal to take the money, and the bullies have uniforms. You pay, one way or another. My backyard was the Dartford Marshes, a no-man's land that stretches 3 miles on either side along the Thames. A frightening place, and fascinating at the same time, but desolate. When I was growing up, as kids, we'd go down to the riverbank, a good half an hour ride on a bike. Essex County was on the other side of the river, the northern shore, and it might as well have been France. You could see the smoke of Dagenham, the Ford plant, and on our side, the Gravesend cement plant. They didn't call it Gravesend for nothing. Everything unwanted by anyone else had been dumped in Dartford since the late 19th century. Isolation and smallpox hospitals, leper colonies, gunpowder factories, lunatic asylums, a nice mixture. Dartford was the main place for smallpox treatment for all of England from the time of the epidemic of the 1880s. The river hospitals overflowed into ships anchored at Longreach, a grim sight in the photographs or if you were sailing up the estuary into London. But the lunatic asylums were what Dartford and its environs were famous for. The various projects run by the dread Metropolitan Asylums Board for the mentally unprepared people, or whatever they call it these days. The deficient in brain. The asylums drew a belt around the area, as if somebody had decided, right, this is where we're going to put the loonies. There was a massive one, very grim, called Darinth Park, which was a kind of labor camp for backward children until quite recent times. There was Stonehouse Hospital, whose name had been changed to something more genteel than the City of London Lunatic Asylum, which had Gothic gables and a tower and observation post Victorian style, where at least one suspect for Jack the Ripper, Levy, was imprisoned and died of syphilis. Some of the nuthouses were harder cases than others. When we were 12 or 13, Mick Jagger had a summer job at the Bexley Nuthouse, the Maypole, as it was called. I think they were a bit more upper-class nutters. They got wheelchairs or something. And Mick used to do the catering, taking round their lunches. Almost once a week you'd hear sirens going. Another loony escaped. And they'd find him in the morning in his little nightshirt, shivering on Dartford Heath. Some of them escaped for quite a while, and you'd see them flitting through the shrubbery. It was a feature of life when I was growing up. You still thought you were at war, because they used the same siren if there was a breakout. You don't realize what a weird place you're growing up in. You'd give people directions. Go past the loony bin, not the big one, the small one. And they'd look at you as if you were from the loony bin yourself. The only other thing that was there was the Wells Firework Factory. Just a few little isolated sheds on the marsh. It blew itself up one night in the 50s, and a few guys with it. Spectacular. As I looked out my window, I thought the war had started again. All the factory was making then was your Tuppney Banger, your Roman Candles and your Golden Shower, and your Jumping Jacks. Everybody from around there remembers that. The explosion that blew the windows out for miles around. One thing you've got is your bike. Me and my mate Dave Gibbs, who lived on Temple Hill, decided it would be cool if we put these little cardboard flappers on the back wheel so it sounded like an engine when the spokes went round. We'd hear, "Take that bloody thing away! I'm trying to get some sleep round here." So we used to ride down to the marshes and the woods by the Thames. The woods were very dangerous country. There were buggers in there, hard men who'd scream at you, "Fuck off!" We took the cardboard flappers out. It was a place of madmen and deserters and tramps. Many of these guys were British Army deserters, a little like the Japanese soldiers who still thought the war was on. Some of them had been living there for 5 or 6 years. They'd cobbled together maybe a caravan or some treehouse for shelter. Vicious, dirty swine they were, too. The first time I got shot was by one of those bastards. A good shot. An airgun pellet on the bum. One of our hangs was a pillbox, an old machine gun post, of which there were many along the tideway. We used to go and pick up the literature, which was always pinups, all crumpled up in the corner. One day we found a dead tramp in there, huddled up, covered in blue bottles. A dead paraffin. Paraffin lamp. Rhyming slang for tramp. Filthy magazines lying around, used rubbers, flies buzzing, and this paraffin had croaked. He'd been there for days, weeks even. We never reported it. We ran like the fucking Nile. I remember going from Aunt Lil's to infant school, to West Hill School, screaming my head off.
"No way, Mum, no way!"
Refusing and kicking and refusing to go, but I did go. They had a way about them, the grown-ups. I put up a fight, but I knew it was a full-on moment. Doris felt for me, but not that much. "This is life, boy. Something we can't fight." I remember my cousin, who was Aunt Lil's son. Big boy. He was at least 15, with a charm that cannot be imagined. He was my hero. He had a check shirt, and he went out when he wanted. I think he was called Reg. Cousin Kay was their daughter. She pissed me off because she had really long legs, could always run faster than me. I came in a valiant second every time. She was older than me, though. We rode my first horse together, bareback. A great old white mare that barely knew what was going on. That had been put out to pasture, if you could call it that, round where we lived. I was with a couple of mates and Cousin Kay, and we got on the fence and managed to get on the horse's back, and thank God she's a sweet mare. Otherwise, if she had taken off, I would have gone for a loop. I had no rope. I hated infant school. I hated all school. Doris said I was so nervous, she remembered bringing me home on her back because I couldn't walk. I was trembling so hard. And this was before the stick-ups and the bullying began. What they fed you was awful. I remember at infant school being forced to eat gypsy tart, which revolted me. I just refused it. It was pie with some muck burned into it, marmalade or caramel. Every school kid knew this pie, and some actually liked it. But it wasn't my idea of a dessert. And they tried to force me to eat it, threatening me with punishment or a fine. It was very Dickensian. I had to write out, "I will not refuse food," 300 times in my infantile hand. And after so many times, I had it down. I will. I was known to have a temper, as if nobody else has one. A temper that was aroused by gypsy tart. In retrospect, the British education system, reeling from the war, had not much to work with. The PT master had just come from training commandos and didn't see why he shouldn't treat you the same as them, even though you were 5 or 6 years old. It was all ex-army blokes. All these guys had been in World War II, and some of them were just back from Korea, so you were brought up with this kind of barking authority. I should have a badge for surviving the early National Service dentists. The appointments were, I think, 2 a year. They had school inspections, and my mum had to drag me screaming to them. She'd have to spend some hard-earned money to buy me something afterwards, because every time I went there was sheer hell. No mercy.
Shut up, kid.
The red rubber apron, like Edgar Allan Poe. They had those very rickety machines in those days, 49, 50. Belt drive drills. Electric chair straps to hold you down. The dentist was an ex-army bloke. My teeth got ruined by it. I developed a fear of going to the dentist, with by the mid-70s visible consequences, a mouth full of blackened teeth. Gas is expensive, so you'd just get a whiff. And also they got more for an extraction than for a filling, so everything came out. They would just yank it out with the smallest whiff of gas, and you'd wake up halfway through an extraction. Seeing that red rubber hose, that mask, you felt like you were a bomber pilot, except you had no bomber. The red rubber mask and the man looming over you like Laurence Olivier in Marathon Man, it was the only time I saw the devil, as I imagined. I was dreaming, and I saw the three-pronged fork, and he was laughing away. And I wake up, and he's going, "Stop squawking, boy! I've got another 20 to do today!" And all I got out of it was a dinky toy, a plastic gun. After a time, the town council gave us a flat over a greengrocer's and a little row of shops in Chestillion Road, two bedrooms and a lounge. Still there. Mick lived one street away, in Denver Road, posh town, we used to call it. The difference between detached and semi-detached houses. It was a 5-minute bike ride to Dartford Heath, and only a street away from my next school, the school Mick and I both went to, Wentworth Primary School. I went back to Dartford to breathe the air not long ago. Nothing much had changed in Chestillion Road. The greengrocer's is now a florist called the Darling Buds of Kent, whose proprietor came out with a framed photograph for me to sign almost the moment I'd stepped onto the pavement. He behaved as if he was expecting me, the picture ready, as unsurprised as if I came every week, whereas I hadn't been around there for 35 years. As I walked into our old house, I knew exactly the number of stairs. For the first time in 50 years, I entered the room where I lived in that house, where the florist now lives. Tiny room, exactly the same. And Bert and Doris in the tiny room across a 3-foot landing. I lived there from about 1949 to 1952. Across the street, there were the co-op and the butchers. That's where the dog bit me. My first dog bite. It was a vicious bugger, tied up outside. Finley's tobacconist was on the opposite corner. The post box was still in the same place, but there used to be a huge hole on Ashton Drive where a bomb dropped, which is now covered over. Mr. Stedman used to live next door. He had a TV, and he used to open the curtains to let us kids watch. But my worst memory, the most painful that came back to me, standing in the little back garden, was the day of the rotten tomatoes. I've had some bad things happen, but this is still one of the worst days of my life. The greengrocer used to stack old fruit crates in the back garden, and a mate and I found all these far-gone tomatoes. We just squidged the whole packet up. We started having a rotten tomato fight, and we splashed them everywhere. Tomatoes all over the place, including all over myself, my mate, the windows, the walls. We were outside, but we were bombing each other. "Take that, swine! Rotten tomato in your face." And I went inside and my mom scared the shit out of me. I've called the man. "What are you talking about?" "I've called the man. He's going to take you away. Because you're out of control." And I broke down. "He's coming here in 15 minutes. He'll be here any minute now to take you away into the home." And I shat myself. I was about 6 or 7. "Oh, Mum," I'm on my knees. I'm pleading and begging. "I've had it up to here with you. I don't want you anymore." "No, Mum, please." "And on top of that, I'm going to tell your dad." "Oh, Mum." That was a cruel day. She was relentless. She kept it going for about an hour, too, until I cried myself to sleep and realized eventually that there was no man at all and that she'd been putting me on, and I had to figure out why. I mean, a few rotten tomatoes? I guess I needed a lesson. "You don't do that around here." Doris was never strict. It was just, This is the way it is. This is what's going to happen, and you're going to